Thank you. I'm Ira, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to introduce our speaker tonight. Our speaker tonight is Dustin. I met Dustin a while ago, and it was funny. I was told, you know, meet some of these guys that I knew that were going to a particular meeting, and Dustin shared. And within 2 minutes, I knew, not only because the beginning of the meeting, they tell you we're a solutions-oriented meeting. If you're not in the solution, keep your mouth shut. They say a little bit nicer than that, but when Dustin shared, he was all about the solution. And right then I knew that, you know, I had found a new good meeting to be at, because that's the people like Dustin. So with that, I give you Dustin.
Thanks, Aaron.
Thanks, Ira. I'm Dustin. I'm an alcoholic and addict. I appreciate getting the chance to share with you guys tonight. I got the email, and it said, you know, dress nicely, basically. And I was okay with that, and then it said don't cuss, and that's going to be a serious challenge. So I will do my best, but I will give the warning that I'm not so good at that. I've been trying to practice every time I share. I've been not cursing. My sobriety date is November 1st of 2010. So God willing, about 2 weeks off from 5 years. My last drink was the end of June 2008. So you might be able to guess that drugs are part of my story. I won't really focus on any of that. I think a lot of people be able to fill in the blanks. And it's really not important. I never really got that. But for me, it's all the same. Because I'm a pure alcoholic. I do everything alcoholically. I can definitely do drugs alcoholically. I can definitely drink alcoholically. I can think alcoholically. It's how I'm wired. That's how I am. And without this program, that's exactly where I'll find myself. My first real drink was I was 13 or 14. Now before that, backing up, I grew up in Tallahassee, Florida. And my mom's an alcoholic. I don't think that really has anything to do with me being an alcoholic, but it did teach me that alcohol was not something that you were honest about, particularly with yourself. And it also interjected into me a little bit of a fear of tiny women that still exists to this day. But I certainly, I believe that there's, four generations as far back on my mom's side as I know of has had a generation, at least one alcoholic in the generation, sometimes more, nevertheless. So I certainly have the genetic component if it exists, but that's not what makes me an alcoholic or made me an alcoholic. I did that all by myself. My parents got divorced when I was 5. Wasn't a real life-changing event. Wasn't particularly surprising to me. I had a very good childhood, but both my parents worked. And I took, even at that time, I took an inordinate amount of pride in being the first latchkey kid at my little elementary school. So, I delighted in the fact that I was coming home to an empty house when I was 6, 7 years old. At that point, sometimes I don't know if normal kids do this or not, because I don't know normal kids. But I used to crack my dad's beers that he had in the refrigerator and then just sip off the fizz. So I'm sure he got a bunch of flat beers and he wondered what the hell was going on. But obviously that wasn't real use. And so then, you know, I had a good childhood. I ended up, you know, I went to a private high school, and I was fortunate. I had a decent number of friends. I was shy, but for some reason, people were probably more drawn to me when I was shy than when I decided that I was popular. In ninth grade, I started playing varsity baseball in ninth grade. And in ninth grade, a friend of mine and then some older kids on the team, we went out. And I asked him, we were going to an FSU football game. I said, well, we're going to drink, right? And he was like, what? And I was like, well, we're going to drink. That's why we go out. And he was like, yeah, well, I guess we can. And I was like, okay, great. We're best friends now. What I remember about that is I probably weighed 130 pounds soaking wet with some rocks in my pockets. And there were four of us, and they bought a case of Budweiser. And I had never drank at that point, really drank. And I'm sitting there thinking, that's not going to be enough. That's not enough. We're going to run out of this, so I need to drink faster than everybody else so I get more than six beers. I did, and I blacked out. And I think threw up. I don't remember. And, you know, some of the sort of anxiety I had slipped away, and that lit me up a little bit. But then the following Monday at school, people were talking about how much I had drank, and that's the first time I heard, well, you know, Taps, he doesn't care. And that lit me up like nothing I've ever felt before. And that was my MO. And, you know, it didn't occur to me for the next 20 years that not caring, that's not like the ultimate compliment. It metamorphosized into other stuff, and it was like Hurricane Taps or whatever. That's not really a compliment. That's not something to aspire to. And the funny part was, the fact of the matter was, I did care. And it was just the fact that people were saying that really, you know, it made me feel like they were buying my bullshit. That's one cuss word. I'll try to. We'll set the over under at a dozen and go backwards from there. That was my pattern. You know, that's how it kind of started. And from there, you know, my deal is, and the two things I remember, I mean, there's first of all blacking out. I always got a kick, you know. I've had the good fortune to be arrested several times and get educated on some things at a pretty early age. And they used to give this, like at DUI school, they give a little handout, and it's like, check this box, you know, do you black out? Have you ever blacked out? And I was like, people don't black out? I mean, honestly, what are they talking about? And that was until I figured out a chemical solution to blacking out, and I stopped blacking out when I probably should have. But that was later down the road, and I guess that's an outside issue, although I don't really buy the term outside issues, because a lot of my issues, they all originate from the same place, and the reason I'm here. But, you know, I am defenseless against the first drink, or the first pill, or the first puff, or the first line, whatever the case may be. But I am terrified and obsessed with the last drink. And I would surround myself with as much quantities as I could, in the hopes to avoid that it was going to run out. But I always knew it was going to run out. You know, I could start a weekend on Wednesday or Thursday, depending on what the case may be. And I didn't, especially towards the end, I didn't enjoy that, because I knew that Sunday or Monday or whatever, I was going to be out. And then I was going to be sad, and I was going to be depressed, and I was going to be ashamed. I was terrified. And my, you know, my drinking and using kind of took me to a place where it was an endless hamster wheel. And I would jump on it, where, you know, I would do something. And, you know, I would start the cycle. I would spark the physical allergy, which would then go to the mental obsession. And I would jump on that wheel, and then I'd run out, or, you know, at some point reality would set in, and then I would be ashamed. And the only way I knew to get rid of being ashamed was to start the cycle again. And that was my life. And that was 20 years of my life. Early on, I think the first time I identified as an alcoholic, I was right, but I had no idea what the hell I was talking about. It was either when I was 14 and had snuck out and trashed a house, or 16 when I got my first DUI, but, you know, I started going to meetings, and, you know, everybody was identifying, and so, well, yeah, I'm Dustin, I'm an alcoholic. What I thought that meant was that I'm Dustin and I get in trouble when I drink, or I drink too much. I always had the theory that I had this just bad luck. Never had worse luck than when I was drinking. Because I would break the law, and lo and behold, somebody would arrest me. And it just didn't seem fair. Over 20 years, there was a lot of running through red lights, literally and figuratively. I was lucky. I played baseball, went into college playing baseball, and I was decent. I was never as good as I pretended to think I was. And I was never as bad as I actually thought I was, because I always kind of overcompensated by acting cocky, kind of acting as if stuff didn't bother me, because that was my defense mechanism to fear, anxiety, everything. That was, you know, and of course, you know, I remember at several junctures, teammates or coaches would say, you know, you're drunk. They wouldn't say you're hungover. They'd say you're drunk. And don't be ridiculous. And like, oh, shit, they know. Oh, well. And so eventually that kind of ran its course. It was really, you know, baseball started getting in the way of my drinking. And I wasn't going to make a living doing it. So I quit and transferred to a school where I could drink with more impunity. Thankfully, and I mean this, you know, when they talk about a higher power, or, you know, in my case, I refer to it as God, my God is infinitely patient. And I have had so many times where I can almost picture him being like, seriously, this is what we're doing. Like, I've given you this opportunity, and this is what you're doing with it. I'm not going to turn this into a drunkalogue, but I was lucky enough and blessed enough to have, I've got a weird memory. I get it from my dad. It's not photographic, but it's close. And that can sometimes be confused as intelligence. I don't say that. That's not false modesty. Seriously, I'm one of the dumbest people I know. But you put a standardized test in front of me, and I'll do all right on it. And that carried me through, and I ended up going to law school. And I had a lot of people that would say, that's what I get a lot now. It says, you're a lawyer, and then they start laughing. I'm like, yes, it's funny because I used to break the law and get arrested a lot. I get it. But then when I tell them I'm sober, that's where minds really start to get blown, because of all my friends. And I hung out with people, which I think a lot of us do, tend to end up with people that may or may not belong in the rooms, but if they don't, they're pretty damn close. But I was going to be the last one that would ever get this. And on my own, I never would have. But anyway, so I come up to Atlanta, and they have like two or three times a year, the Georgia Bar they have a fitness committee, and they'll have a conference with people. So I went to the fitness committee, and the woman, she takes my piece of paper, looks at it, looks at me, and she says, quite a rap sheet. And I was like, oh, this is going to be fun. And basically, she runs through my transgressions, and I sit there and just complete bullshit. Yep, I learned from that one. Yep, I learned from that one. Just trying to just get out of the damn room. At that point, I don't know that I even wanted my license as bad as I just wanted to get out of the fucking room. I didn't say that out loud, so it doesn't count. Towards the over-under. And so I ended up doing a good enough job of placating the fitness committee, and then I had to write a paper about how I'd rehabilitated myself and things like that. And I had not rehabilitated myself. If anything, things were getting worse. And then we went, I think it wasn't the weekend that they finally kind of let me in to the bar, admitted me, but it might have been the next weekend. We went out, and I had bad luck in that I was breaking up a fight and somehow got accused of assault. I thought I'd basically put a lot of time and money and effort into something, and I thought they were going to yank my bar card. Now, the bar manager didn't end up showing up, so they dropped the charges. But that didn't put a dent in me. I mean, that did not stop me at all. That was gone so fast. So now I'm in Atlanta, and suddenly, I was making a little more money than I thought I was going to make. And lo and behold, all my quote-unquote friends were suddenly bartenders who also had side businesses that cost me a decent amount of money. Over the years, every once in a while, I'll sit down and figure out how much money it cost me, and then I'll cry myself to sleep. And no, I'm actually thankful for it because it brought me to where I'm at now. Ended up meeting my wife, who's also an addict, in recovery at this point. But it was just gas on a fire from there. And one of the things I lost, I'd always been, for whatever reason, I'd been lucky. I'd been really, really lucky, although I never would have seen it, to have good friends and real friends throughout, you know, throughout growing up, even into college. Now, I had no idea what a friend was, and I didn't care. You know, that's a promise that, for me, you know, I can't necessarily read it in the book, but at this point, if somebody, you know, if in my disease, I can sit across from you, look at you, and spend hours with you, and I don't know what we are. I don't know if we're business acquaintances. I don't know if you're using me, if I'm using you. I don't care. It doesn't matter. Because I'm so in self-will that all I'm trying to do is make myself feel different than what I feel. And this program's given me back friendships and actually knowing what a friend is. Now, if somebody, you know, if somebody's my friend, it's probably not because I'm going to buy them drugs. It better not be, because I ain't going to buy them any drugs. It's not because I'm going to make an ass of myself. It's none of those things, which is really beautiful. What made me stop drinking was my wife and I decided to have kids. Probably, honestly, wasn't the best idea at the time, but we were ready to start a family. So we decided that we probably shouldn't be rolling through a couple grand of cocaine a month if we wanted to have children. So we had to do something, because I couldn't be sober. That was an absurd proposition. We ended up cross addicting to pain pills off the internet, even though I didn't really care for them much. It was different than being sober, and it was a way to sort of partially numb me. We had gone through some fertility treatments, and there'd been one with a real low percent of possibility of getting pregnant, and we were on a bender, but just pain pills, so it didn't really count in our minds at that point. And then we got a call from the clinic, and it was like, "Congratulations, Dad." And I'm like, what? The fog lifted for a second. I was like, holy shit, we're pregnant. And then she miscarried. Now, I don't know if it was the pain pills or not, but that was enough for me to say, okay, you know, I'm going to stop drinking, and really take a shot at this. And then I witnessed, you know, so then she did get pregnant. We ended up finding out we were having twins, and a little boy and a little girl. And they were born on April 24th, 2009. And that was the first miracle that I saw. I thought that would hold me. I thought that would keep me sober, and all of a sudden, my thinking was going to clear up, and everything was going to be good. I started going to meetings, but I was just punching the clock. You know, I would go and I would look at the promises. And I'd be like, you know, they had the steps on the wall, and I would read the first two steps. I'd misread them. You know, step one, I'd say, okay, admitted that you have a drinking problem. That's not what it says, but that's what I read. Yeah, I've got a drinking problem. You know, I get arrested, and you know, I'm kind of an asshole when I drink. And yeah, okay, that's one. Two, I read as believe in God. Like, yeah, I believe in God. So there you go. All right, two steps, I'm done. And then my eyes like gravitated down to nine. And I was like, I am not doing that. Because that looks like it sucks. And then at the end of the meeting, they'd read the promises, and I'd be like, well, that shit ain't happening for me. And I don't get it. And then my first sponsor told me, well, those are ninth step promises, so if you want to get those, you probably should do the first nine steps. It's like, oh, you got me. So I went to the occasional meeting, thought that I was punching the clock well enough. You know, my kids, I guess my kids were like 10 months old or whatever. I decided I wanted to feel different, but I didn't want to do anything bad. So I picked the substance that I thought I could manage or control. I'm big on control, and it's the delusion of control, because I'm so out of control when I'm working on my own schedule and my own will that it's a joke for me to even use the word control. But anyway, I decided I could do that, and then, you know, it didn't take long, probably 2 weeks, and I'm getting high in the bathroom while the kids are watching cartoons by myself for no reason, 10 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, somehow, and honestly, it's divine intervention, I realized that wasn't right. I realized that was unmanageable. I was not managing that. And I can't draw lines. If I draw lines, you could clone me and put me next to me. And not only will I tell you in great detail why I'm different than my clone, but I'll be good and he'll be bad. So if I get to draw the line, any kind of line, I'll be right on the edge of it, but on the good side. You know, in golf they call it pencil whipping. And that's basically, and it used to drive me nuts when people would do that. It's like, if you're keeping your own score, you just write down a lower score than what you actually got on the hole. That used to drive me nuts when I played golf in tournaments and stuff. But I was doing it in the grand scale of life. If I was the one making the call, I was always all right, no matter how far from all right I was. So at that point, I white-knuckled it. And I stopped, but I just white-knuckled it. And I tell sponsees, and I will tell anybody willing to listen, I can't tell you what to do in early sobriety, but I can damn sure tell you what not to do. Because I don't like asking for help. And I did that for about 18 months. I just hung on. And I felt like a bottle of soda that had been shaken up. And, you know, if the top opened a little bit, I'd fizz. If it opened completely, I'd overflow, and it'd be a mess. And, I mean, I was yelling at people at work and just yelling at clients. And it was like it was an absurd way to live, you know, because it was almost crazier than when I was in my disease. Because if I'm in my disease, you know, then okay, I'm an asshole because of drugs and alcohol. If I don't have drugs and alcohol and I'm still an asshole, then what am I? Just an asshole. Then the second miracle happened, and that was my wife. My wife had gone back to the pain pills after having the kids. And she got sober, and she went through treatment. She got a sponsor. She worked the steps. She got sober. And seeing that, I mean, that was a miracle to me. Like that was, I couldn't recognize her. And she was actually getting what I saw in all of you that actually did the program and what I wanted, but just seemed so foreign to me. And that was serenity, and that was some sort of inner peace and being happy. I mean, I saw people, I'd be like, what are these idiots laughing about? Like, why are they happy? They're not drinking. I know they're not drinking, you know. That guy over there is drug tested, so he can't be drinking. Why am I pissed off and he's happy? I'm much more sober than him, but I didn't get it. And then about 18 months in, I had an absolute, because I'll always have a thinking relapse first, and then probably a behavioral relapse, and then ultimately, if I don't check it at that point, it's going to be a using or drinking relapse. My wife was asleep, and I was laying awake with the wheels turning because I was a dry drunk, and basically in untreated alcoholism, and in my disease up here. And I was like, she's using. I know she's using. So I start going through. I start going through the medicine cabinet and stuff, and I found a baggie with little pills in it. So I woke her up. I don't think that it wasn't the time I threw water in her face while she was asleep. I think I just woke her up just screaming at her. That was a classy time too, but this one was worse. Because I was screaming at her and just yelling, and I'm going to take the kids and I'm moving back to Florida and you're relapsing and how could you do this? And she was like, slow down, why don't you look up on the computer, you know, you get the little pill identifier. So I looked it up and they were Claritin, and it was Claritin that, and I was like, oh shit, and it was Claritin. And I remembered I had gotten something in my eye, and her parents had given me Claritin in a bag. And I mean, I guess that's what it took. But I've never felt that small in my life, and I probably still wouldn't have gotten it if. You know, the next day I was apologetic. That's why I had my tail understandably tucked between my legs, and I was just like, I'm sorry, I'm such an asshole. She said, I know. what she said next was, you don't have to live that way. You need to get a sponsor. You've talked about getting a sponsor. You haven't gotten a sponsor. Because that's my thing. I don't like to ask for help. Then I had picked out my sponsor, and I was like, I'll get to the meeting early. Now, at that point, I think I had, you know, like 2.5, 3-year-old twins. You don't get anywhere early when you have 2.5, 3-year-old twins. And I don't get anywhere early anyway, so. So it didn't happen for like 3 weeks, and then finally I leveled my pride and I asked for help. And you know, I had all these stupid questions, but at the time I thought they were so important, like, what is my sobriety date? Because I would like my sobriety date to be the last time I drank alcohol, because I'm keeping score, and I want as many years as I can possibly have. And he was like, well, why don't we do some of these steps? And I think you'll see that that's not important. And he was right. And, you know, that was transformational to me. Because, you know, I'm coming up on 5 years, but I'd say, I mean, a lot of that first year and a half, man, it sucked. And I had no idea what was on the other side. And I am, you know, and now that I've seen it, I don't know how I missed it, but I do, if that makes any sense. There's still things in this program that are counterintuitive to me. The only way that I have any semblance of self-control is to let go of control. That doesn't make sense to me. The only way that I can tap into a power greater than myself is to admit that I'm powerless. That doesn't make sense to me. But it works. So I started doing it, and lo and behold, things started freeing up. I actually read the steps, you know. The first step, I am powerless over alcohol. You know, I've heard a lot of people share, and they're like, well, I'll go to a wedding or dinner or whatever, and wonder how people can drink a glass of wine or, you know, leave a drink half full. I was a lot sicker than that. I had a friend who is now in the program that he used to go to happy hour, and he used to, you know, he used to drink as fast as possible, but he'd be out of there by like 7 or 8 o'clock, and I was like, what the hell's wrong with you, you know? You're going home. You're supposed to be up for the next 36 hours, and you're supposed to go places you're not supposed to be, and you're supposed to lie about it. And like, man, if I could only drink responsibly like that, like, you know, 8 vodka and Red Bulls and then go home to the wife, I would be doing all right. But that's how powerless I am. That's how my delusion, and it hasn't for me. I really think, and Ira and I have talked about this, and Mitch and I have talked about this, I think I will be 70 years old, and I will drive by a bar and think I could go in there and have a drink, and nobody would know. And I'm equally sure that if I went in there, I wouldn't stop. That's my reality. That is my reality. I'm powerless over alcohol. You know, I never had any problem believing that there was power greater than me. I did have a problem with the fact that he could restore me to sanity, or that he cared, you know. I was like, hey, he's got bigger fish to fry than me, and just running around like a junkie. But now I know that, you know, my higher power cares for me and all of us infinitely, and he has enough love to love all of us and care about what all of us do. The third step's probably the biggest step in my recovery, and it's the one that I have to work the hardest on, and I think is probably the most important, because it goes into every other step, and I have to, you know, I have to turn stuff over, because I'm the type of egomaniac that I will put God on a clock. I mean, who does that? I put God on a clock. I say, okay, you can have this, God. Here's what I'd like you to do with it, and here's how long you got. And after that, I'm taking it back, because I got it. I can't do that. I can't do that with any situation in my life. I certainly can't do that with my disease. You know, the ninth one's one that a lot of people, you know, four and five. I've done the steps a couple times. Four is a strange one, because I really was honest the first time I did the fourth step. But I left so much out, particularly fears, because I still had my ego. And for some reason, for me, it's more acceptable to have resentments, anger, and harms than it is to have fears. But, you know, a lot of my disease is fear-driven. My disease thrives on fear. And it's, you know, it's about not getting what I want when I want it. That terrifies me, that things, when things aren't happening at my pace or how I think they should, that scares me. And I've always been scared. This is true. When I was, I guess, 4 or 5, there were the Atlanta child murders. I think a lot of people are probably too young to remember those, but a guy was killing black kids in the inner city of Atlanta, and I was convinced, absolutely convinced, that he was going to make a special trip down to Tallahassee, Florida, completely go off his MO as far as victims, just to come get me. And it would keep me up at night just because I was sure of it. I was just as sure as I could be. But I have a lot of fear that I have to turn over. My first fifth step and the subsequent fifth steps have been, you know, those have been great. I think I was blessed that I didn't know what the fifth step was. I just thought it was the one after four, you know, I'd made a list and okay, I get to tell my sponsor about all these sons of bitches who did me wrong. So it was kind of miraculous when that kind of turned around and I was able to see that, you know, it was all me. And then 9, the promises of 9, and lo and behold, they started coming true. So my toughest 9th step was with my mom. There's a solid 30-year history of 30-year history of her lying to me about alcohol. I think she got remarried when I was 8 to my stepdad, who's a wonderful man and extremely codependent. Like, you look up codependent in the dictionary and there he is. But a very, very kind, one of the kindest men I've ever met. But I asked my mom, I said, you know, at that point, I said, will you please not drink at your wedding? She said, sure, I won't drink. So then she got drunk at her wedding because she's an alcoholic and that's what we do. That was the first time I literally saw somebody change, like snap. She was apologetic, and then the liquor hit her and her face turned. She cussed me out in front of everybody at her wedding. That amends got complex. And then there was issues with, you know, I was waiting for her to say, you know, the way my sponsor had me do it was to say, to make the amends. Say, here's what I'm going to try to do. Is there anything else I can do? And that last part terrified me because I was ready for, I'd like to come into town every other week and stay with the kids. And I was just ready for her to whip out a laundry list. And what he told me was, you don't have to have faith in her. And this has carried me in other challenges where I'm just like, there's no way that this program can apply to this situation. It just can't. They said, you don't have to have faith in her. You're never going to have faith in her. I'd probably question your sanity and whether you'd relapsed if you did suddenly have faith in her. But have faith in the process. And that was the best amends I did. That was the best amends I had. And there was no list. The only time I had to stop her was when, you know, she would try to tell me how it went both ways. And I was like, I know, but we're dealing with me right now. And I got plenty on my side of the street. 10 and 11, I mean, to me, those are kind of an extended 3, 4, and 5. I don't do them as much as I should or as thoroughly as I should. When I do, I feel much better. I do, I have my current sponsors told me about the 24-hour plan, which is the 10th step, basically. My first sponsor, you know, this is where I kind of could tell that I always thought I was really good at hiding my dry drunkenness and agitation and stuff. But I've had three sponsors, and they're about as different as they could possibly be. All of them have had me, you know, said, okay, well, why don't you get into 84 to 88? A lot of them, my first sponsor particularly was, and my second one, said, you know, just read the bottom of 87 and the top of 88, which is basically pause when you're agitated. So I was thinking that nobody could tell I was even agitated, so I was like, why are you telling me to do that? You're pissing me off. But I've gotten better at it. I'm not great, but I've gotten better at it. And it's definitely progress, not perfection. And then, you know, 12's huge. I can't, you know, 12's a miracle. I never thought I'd be in any position to do anything remotely 12-step-ish. It doesn't have to be sponsor to sponsee. It can be sitting there with somebody from the program watching a football game. And it's just listening. I mean, for me, even when I sponsor guys, you know, the guys I sponsor all have something that they do better than I do. And, you know, so that maybe it's just the desire to, you know, maybe it's still that passion. And, you know, I'll borrow that from them and I'll lean on them because it keeps me sober. The best thing I think I did last year, the thing I was proudest of last year, it didn't have anything to do with money or anything like that. I went down and I told my story down at the Salvation Army. I guess that's Prior Street?
Yeah.
It's down, yeah, so... I don't know if anybody's ever done that. There is a decent chance that not one damn person heard anything I said. You know, I got done and asked if anybody had any questions. And what's your drug of choice? Don't you remember when I said it doesn't matter? It doesn't, because it doesn't. And I don't really have one. Yeah, but if you had to name one, what would you? Okay, it's cocaine. Okay, you happy? What kind? Okay, next question. But even though there's a chance that nobody heard me, there's also a pretty good chance that somebody did. You know, and if one person did, that's the best thing that I can do. Because this program works, and, you know, it worked for me. And they talk about bottoms, you know, my bottom, I don't know, I don't like to compare people's bottoms. All I know is mine sucked. And it wasn't necessarily any kind of external thing, you know. I managed to somehow not get arrested for almost 10 years before I quit. Well, I got arrested, but not prosecuted, so that's, I'll take it. But the way I felt kept getting worse and worse and worse. And I was doing stuff that I said I'd never do. And then I was doing it again. And then I was saying, well, I did it, but I won't do this. And then I'd do that. And that was how things spun. That's how it works with me. But this program can get me sober. It can get anybody sober. It's a simple set of instructions. It's not easy, though. It amazes me how hard it can be. But, you know, anything that's good, it's not going to be that easy. It can be simple. And sometimes I don't want to follow instructions. Sometimes just because I don't want to be told what to do by a book or by anybody else. But I need to because if I do what I want to do, it's a train wreck. I've got a relationship with my kids that I never thought I would have. I've got a relationship with my fellows that I never thought I would have. And I've got a relationship with God that I never thought I would have. And I'm not giving it back. I'm going to do my damnedest not to give it back. I can't make guarantees. But I want to keep it because it's pretty good. I wouldn't call it intuition at this point. It's not. There's a difference between intuition and reflex for me. My reflex is generally wrong. It's just like, you know, somebody hits me on the knee, I want to drink a beer instead of kicking. But, or punch them. Stop hitting me. But now, you know, now I like to think that I've developed a conscience. And for me, that means being God conscious. And I don't always know what God's will is for me. And sometimes that's okay, as long as I know what God's will for me isn't, you know. Sometimes it's hard to see what God's will is, but it's usually pretty easy to see that what it's not, you know. It usually looks like me trying to take it all back and get instant gratification, control, whatever particular delusion I'm chasing in the moment. But this program, it really works when you work it. And I would like to think I'm somewhat of an example of that. I'm sure there are much better ones, but that's what I got.